This is spring. This is spring, knocking at my door, hunched like a haggard woman, shaking the snow off a tweed coat, divesting from the cold wear her woolen hat, scarf and gloves, and stepping out of fur-lined boots. This is spring, while she visibly alters, age falling from her as she smiles, cheeky as a child calling me out to play. But the glint in her eye is that of a tease. She might blow cold, force me to wrap up. She might glow warm, make me strip back. This is spring, incorrigible, never boring. Cheerleader, motivator, heart retriever. She traveled while we slept in the caves of winter. Her presence stirs the souls of seeds long planted, scatters darkness, the eternal mother bearing new life. This is spring, and as she brightens, she moves in pulsing rhythm, hips sway, wrens chorus, skirts ruffle to green, lambs start to ramble as daffodils flow in full swing. Spring is in her element. Watch her dance, barefooted, across the land.
The bird of our youthful married days was Bob Dylan. Then another individual who also went by the name of Bob Dylan and who came to mean as much to us flew into our lives in that flat on the top of the house overlooking Belgrave Square and the Irish Sea, where we were rearing our three sons. This Bob, a Yorkshire guardsman and our flatmate for a year, didn't sing in the same strident rockabilly hobo way as Bob Zimmerman from Minnesota, the sad-eyed lady of the lowlands way, but he sure sang. He arrived one morning at our flat, as we'd arranged with his own flatmates of that time. I called them Thomas and Ollie. He came on the back of a Honda 50. Thomas drove, Ollie on the pillion and holding Bob. Because of the blanket draped over him, Bob couldn't see where he was going. Thomas and Ollie were planning to head off for Brighton. They'd heard it was one of the most pleasant places anywhere for people like themselves, adventurous and alternative. They would take the motorbike and the ferry from Dunleary and drive on from there to Brighton. Bob would stay with us. After some months, they'd return and collect him. That day, as Thomas and Ollie looked ahead to the stony foreshores of Brighton, their hair and faces shone, and I could almost touch the excitement from them. Ollie, though, the smaller, slighter of the two, did send backward glances at Bob. He showed us the food Bob preferred and the bedding to spread on the floor of his gilded abode. He then pursed his lips, a goodbye kiss in Bob's direction. "I'll miss you and your singing, my little canary," he said. Yes, Bob was a canary, a slate blue canary rather than the far more common yellow. Yorkshire Guardsman was the name of his breed. It affected us that day to see how Ollie, a grown man, backed slowly away from his pet canary as it stood to attention on its perch, even though we laughed when Thomas, in gruffer tones, responded to Ollie with, "Sure, won't you have me to sing to you?" At first, Bob kept silence. It was as though his corner was a place of mourning. Our sons showed a keen interest, feeding him, changing his bed litter, wondering when he'd sing. They'd look in at him and he'd look back from his perch. That was the only communication. We'd placed his spacious cage high in the corner of the front room, and it certainly had to be high. There were cats in the basement flat of the big house we lived in, predators, always on the prowl. always attempting to paw open the doors and the stairs that divided the flats. Then one fine morning, so fine it kicked us into spring cleaning, we hung him from a hook high in the arch of the dormer window that overlooked the square, with its high trees and a sea beyond of yachts and blueness. Birdsong from the trees outside carried up to us. Bob must have heard it too, for he turned his head to the sound. Then he stiffened on his perch, and like a starting handle had set him in motion, his throat opened to the heavens. Bob sang through each passing season. Golden notes tumbled from him so varied and without pause, you wondered he didn't run out of puff. Ollie wrote once and asked how he was, but gave no return address. As time went on, and we didn't hear again from Ollie, we began to think of Bob as our own bird. Until that fateful afternoon, we went upstairs to the room, following a day spent outdoors. The Assyrians had come down like a wolf from the fold. Birdseed was scattered across the faded green carpet. Fluffy feathers still floated on the air. The cage lay on its side, Bob within, fatally bunched up. You could see what had happened. Bob's cage would have fallen from its perch when the cat sprang at it. Then, when the cat reached in and tried to yank him out, the shock would have stopped his small heart. Someone had left the adjoining doors between the flats ajar. The cat had but acted on instinct. We were distraught. We should have taken better care of Bob. Time passed, until one day we had an unexpected visitor, Ollie, back from Brighton, on his own. He was wearing a long grey overcoat. It was winter. The coat made him look smaller than usual. What I remember is how drawn his face seemed, and that was even before we sat him down and told him. The room never seemed so silent. Then the sobbing began, and the tears poured down his face. We got him a cup of tea. He waved it away. We said we were sorry. Nothing was your fault, he said. We made small talk. How was Thomas? How was Brighton? He shook his head. Didn't seem to want to talk about it. He remarked on the birdcage, still hanging where we had put it back up that day. There was one inward bend in its wire framework. He made to rise from his chair to walk back into the day. The cage, it's not too damaged. Would you take it to Brighton, we said. You and Thomas should get another canary. He'd left Brighton, he told us then. Nor would he be returning there. Thomas and he wouldn't be living together anymore. After some moments, he rose. He tightened his coat so as to lend himself an air of determination. It's time to let go, he said. I looked out the window after he left. I saw him cross the park and go alone beneath the bare winter trees.
The term Hallmark holiday is a term of disparagement. So is chocolate box when it's used as an adjective. Chocolate box emotions, for instance. And yet, for all that, I never walk into a greeting card shop without falling into a mood of deep serenity or even of tenderness. The aroma that fills the air of these card shops is the most immediately distinctive thing about them, usually an aroma of scented candles. Scented candles are funny things. They don't always give off much scent when lit. When you're trying to smell their scent, it's hardly there. But when they catch you by surprise, like when you walk into one of these shops, the scent seems overwhelming, flooding your memory and soul. This could be a metaphor for so many things, from national character to romantic love. I like greeting card shops because I like looking at the shelves and reflecting that every single purchase made there is going to make somebody feel happy or loved, or at the very least, remembered. Some people claim to be completely indifferent to birthday cards or Valentine's Day cards or Christmas cards, but I don't believe they are. I think they're lying, if only to themselves. Gestures are the currency of love, the currency of respect, the currency of belonging. I remember in my teens being deeply moved by a passage in Oscar Wilde's essay De Profundis, when Wilde wrote about the occasion after his conviction, when he was surrounded by a hostile crowd, in the midst of which one loyal friend raised his hat to him. Later, when I read King Lear, I felt ferocious sympathy for Lear himself, when he divides his kingdom amongst his three daughters and asks each of them to tell him how much she loves him. His youngest daughter, Cordelia, not wanting to flaunt her love for the sake of reward, refuses to match her sister's extravagant claims, and the entire tragic series of events is set in motion. Cordelia is the play's heroine, but I'm sure that, like me, many generations of the play's readers and audience members have wondered why she had to be so cruel, why she couldn't just give the old man the words he craved. Of course, there are more than greeting cards in greeting card shops. There are teddy bears, chocolate boxes, mugs, helium balloons, and all manner of merchandise, which some people might call overpriced trash. Many of the trinkets bear mottos or quotations of the inspiring kind. A journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. Believe in the magic of your dreams. Now, I love classic poetry. I realise that subtlety and restraint and elegance of form belong in the realm of the poet. And I can see there's a difference between a line like, "In the spring a young man's fancy likely turns to thoughts of love," and a humble motto like, "Believe in the magic of your dreams." But I can't help it. In fact, I don't really want to help it. Going into these shops, looking through the vast array of cards, birthday cards for every age, new baby cards, new home cards, Valentine's cards, get well soon cards, funny cards, thank you cards, retirement cards, I'm sorry cards, reading through the slogans has, on occasion, reduced me to tears. Whenever I admit this to anyone, they think I'm exaggerating, or being ironic, or contrarian, when I'm actually telling the God's honest truth. To me, there's an important idea at stake, which is this. It's understandable, and it's desirable, that artists should wish to express original ideas in an original way. But maybe because we're afraid to be seen as sentimental or unsophisticated, I think we're sometimes also in danger of straying away from the primary, obvious emotions, the simple truths, what I might call the daily bread of humanity. This isn't just a danger for poets and writers, but for all of us. There are those who would hurry past such shops with a single dismissive word, commercialization. But commerce is just another strand in the fabric of our lives. Is an engagement ring commercialization? Is a doll on Christmas morning? Besides, nobody spends big bucks on a world's best dad mug or a get well soon card. Greeting card shops, to me, are a huge fireplace where we can warm ourselves on the obviousness, the simplicity, of the elemental emotions expressed in these mottos. Home is wherever mom is. May all your dreams come true. I love all of you with all of me. Yes, they deserve far more praise than they get.
He's 6 foot tall. He weighs 11 stone, 13 pounds. His eyes are blue and his hair black. Apart from English, he also speaks French and German. His mother was Swiss, from the Canton de Vaud, in the western French-speaking part of the country, and he himself was born in Zurich. And then there's his lifestyle. He smokes heavily, an average of 60 a day, and he likes a drink, but not to excess. Women he also likes, often to excess. Although born in Switzerland, he moved to the south of England to live with his aunt in a village in Kent when he was orphaned at the age of 11. He was sent to Eton, but he didn't stay. Some shenanigans with a young maid the cause of his sudden departure. So he finished his education at the school in Edinburgh that his father had also attended. He's an all-round athlete and a brilliant shot. He's also a champion boxer. He has two scars on his body, one down his right cheek and the other on his left shoulder. and signs of plastic surgery on the back of his right hand. And his name? Bond. James Bond. All these details about history's most famous fictional spy we know because his creator, Ian Fleming, drip-fed them in his novels. But the picture they paint in our heads is not of the Hoagie Carmichael lookalike that Fleming thought he had created, but rather of someone else altogether. But who? David Niven? Sean Connery? Roger Moore? George Lazenby? Pierce Brosnan? Daniel Craig? Take your pick. All have played Bond on the big screen and all have left their mark. And so it is that when we think of Bond, we think of him in cinematic terms. That's the magnetism of the medium, the enduring power of film. We go to the cinema to escape the real world, and yet all manner of reality actually lies there. And so we laugh, we cry, we feel fear and anger, hope and despair. And we lock the images away in our heads, and we return to them time and again over the years. Videos, DVDs, and now Netflix and co. All cinema stand-ins that never come close to the real thing. It doesn't even have to be the stunning vista of, say, Montana in The Horse Whisperer, or that terrifying opening scene in Cliffhanger. Everything just looks better, feels better, is better in the cinema. Films are such touchstones to our lives, often triggering a particular memory, transporting us to a different place, different time, different phase of our existence, even when you just spot them in the TV listings. I see The Great Gatsby there, for example, the Robert Redford one, and I can still feel the heat of a summer's evening as I walk into a small cinema in Harrogate in Yorkshire with my father back in 1974. Any reference to the Leo DiCaprio version, meanwhile, makes me smile as I remember myself virtually alone in the Dundrum Cinema Complex at the 11:15 Saturday morning screening on the weekend it opened in 2013. Alone because my husband refused to accompany me on the basis that I would be huffing and puffing if it wasn't true to the novel. I loved it. And so he came back with me the very next morning and we watched it together in another echo-empty cinema. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. That's me as a young teenager, glued to the screen in the Palladium Cinema in Coleraine on a Saturday afternoon and utterly mesmerised by the beauty of Paul Newman and Robert Redford. It was the first time I realised that men could be described that way. A few years later, it's the same cinema, boyfriend now in tow, and I'm watching The Godfather and later Chinatown. It was in the Coleraine Palladium, indeed, where my love of cinema really began. The Parent Trap with a very young Hayley Mills springs to mind, and 2000 Leagues Under the Sea, the Jules Verne classic released when I was a young child. Later, when I saw Taxi Driver in a small cinema in Egberth in Liverpool in the mid-70s, I had no idea that it would become one of the most famous films of all time. Or indeed, when I went to see a film called Star Wars in the same cinema at around the same time, that 40 years later, the world would still be eagerly awaiting the latest offerings in the Star Wars story, and that in the second decade of the 21st century, it would put Skellig Michael on the international map. Film, like life, has its heroes and villains. As children, we see only the two dimensions, goodies and baddies. As we grow older, the edges blur. And so, yes, we can feel empathy for Matt Damon as Jason Bourne, for Max, played so magnificently by James Woods in Once Upon a Time in America, even for Al Pacino as Michael Corleone, and of course, for whoever is playing 007. All far from perfect people, but with enough duality going on to keep us riveted. How could you ever forget, for example, the tenderness of Daniel Craig's Bond in that fully dressed shower scene with Vesper Lynd in Casino Royale? Through cinema, we connect to a world outside our own, savouring experiences that would never feature in our everyday lives. When we step into that darkened room, we also step away from our own everyday world and into one where that sense of the commonplace has the potential to become so much more. We have now entered a space where ordinary people can become extraordinary, where redemption really does exist, where love is found and lost and found again. On the cinema screen, we discover the meaning and potential of our own lives. It shows us, in effect, what it is to be human. The anguish of Sophie and Sophie's Choice, the pent-up grief of Lee Chandler in Manchester by the Sea, the bravery of Donald Woods in Cry Freedom, the familial viciousness of Blanche and her sister in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, the heartbreaking sacrifice of Francesca Johnson in The Bridges of Madison County. It's all there, all human life and emotion.
The crack was good in Cricklewood, and they wouldn't leave the crown. With bottles flying and biddies crying, the paddies were coming to town. It was from Dominic Bean's song McAlpine Fusiliers that I first heard of the Crown pub in London's Cricklewood. As a teenager in the 1970s, I sang it many times, but I was lucky enough never to have stood outside the bar, frequented by Irish labourers, looking for the subbies' nod and a day's work. Now, in 1988, as a staff photographer with independent newspapers, I was in London to illustrate an article on the Irish in that great city who are not doing too well. It was 6:30 a.m. and I'd come to photograph the latter-day labourers as they lined up for work. I stood outside the Crown pub and marvelled at its size. I hadn't imagined it quite like this, with its imposing stature and red stone. The Victorian window stood tall and its name, writ large, shone in gold. It was magnificent. The Crown pub stands on Cricklewood Broadway, now part of the A5, which runs all the way from London to Holyhead. The A5 itself follows an ancient road paved by the Romans after invading Britain in AD 43. Following the Act of Union in 1801, the road was improved and extended to pave the way from Dublin to London. It's been fairly busy ever since. To my relief, on the morning of my visit, there were no navvies lining the pavement. I stood a moment imagining what it must have been like back in the day, and eventually headed off in search of coffee. I rounded a corner, my camera still tucked under my ex-army jacket, and was stopped in my tracks at the sight of about 30 men, aged between around 16 and 60, leaning against the wall of the Cricklewood Cafe. They smoked, drank takeaway tea, and stood mainly in small groups. A few stood alone, all awaiting an offer. I joined a bus queue across the road, raised my camera and watched through my lens. No one gave me a glance. A van slows down and crawls by the queue. The subby looks to hire. The men straighten themselves now. Some breathe deep. Some clear their throats and spit. Some dig their hands deep into their pockets as if to find courage. As the van cruises along, they all in turn stoop to look through the window, smile and nod, attempting to make eye contact, hoping to be picked up. As it passes, they follow with their eyes, never giving up. I'm still watching through my camera. The subby in the van nods to one of the men, who hurries to the window. Some brief words are exchanged, the door opens, and he's away. The others huddle back into their groups, light cigarettes, and keep one sharp eye down the street for the next chance. As I study them through my lens, moving from face to face, I realise one is a former schoolmate of mine. I put away my camera and I cross over the road to him. He remembers me, but his first question is, have I any smokes? He's anxious. He constantly taps the ash off the cigarette before it forms and needs a second smoke before I've finished my first. He tells me he has to get work today. If not, he's going robbing and he's already in trouble with the law. Another van comes. As if in a trance, his head turns. He stands on his half-smoked second cigarette and peers in through the van window. The window rolls down. Before he moves towards the van, he starts talking to himself. He's cursing his friends. They should be here. He's at the window now. I hear £30 being mentioned, but the subby wants two men. The mates. He curses the mates. His eyes scan the other contenders furiously. Who will he pick? Who can he trust? Who's the best? He curses his mates again. He throws out the subby's line to one of the men. all of whom rise at 5:30 every morning and make their way to the Cricklewood Cafe to be asked a stupid bloody question. "Do you want a day's work?" he shouts. There's a tremble in his voice and panic on his face. A small group breaks up as one answers, "Aye." The van door is banged shut and they're away down the A5. Those remaining huddle together again and light more cigarettes. I stay until 9:30, when at least 20 of them stub out their last smoke and shuffle away to bear someone bad tidings. The oldest of them all looks over his shoulder one last time, takes his red bandana from his neck and puts it in his pocket. I thought of my schoolmate in the van, and I thought of our teacher, Brother Cormac, trying to teach us Leaving Cert Latin. "Lads, we'll have to get the last mark out of our Roman history," he'd say. "None our Latin grammar would let us down. We learned Livy and Caesar. We loved Hannibal in the Alps. And we learned of the Romans building great roads. Roads like Watling Street, the road out of London through Cricklewood, the present-day A5, which my schoolmate was now trundling down. He had won today's battle, but what about the second declension? Bellum, 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 belli, bello, bello, bella, 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 bellorum, bellis, bellis. Ah, down the glen came MacAlpine's men with their shovels slung behind them."
Love needs. There needs to have been a winter, harsh and extraordinary, where you strip down like a leafless tree, your branches black and bare. Your heart needs to have been emptied and spare, hollowed out and waiting. You need to have grown resilient and strong. You need to have regrouped, be sanctuary to your undersong, and gathered yourself to your true self again. You need to become home to your own heart. Then, when spring inches in, you need to leaf up, green out, and flourish, tender, wild, and strong. Your heart needs to blow open with blossoms, scatter buds like fat drops of rain. You need to feel March winds, those April fevers.
This morning's collection of new and archive writing on Sunday Miscellany began with "This is Spring," a poem by Denise Blake. Then we heard "Bird of Our Youth" by Leo Cullen. That was followed by "The Poetry of the Obvious" by Moilchachlan O'Hialley. Then "Cinema Paradiso" by Rosalind D. After that, we heard "Friend, Roman Countryman" by Brian Farrell. And finally, "Love Needs," a poem by Jean O'Brien. This morning's music was Bach's Partita No. 1 in B-flat major, Prelude, played on piano by Glenn Gould. The second piece of music was "Tell Me That It Isn't True" by Bob Dylan. That was followed by "You're Nobody Till Somebody Loves You" by Dean Martin. The penultimate piece of music this morning was the unmistakable James Bond theme, composed by Monty Norman, arranged by John Barry, and played by Monty Norman and his orchestra. And finally, we heard MacAlpine's Fusiliers, written by Dominic Behan and performed by the Dubliners.